Blog Talk Radio.
A global catastrophic disaster. Disasters can happen at any time and at any place. Human conflict. Nuclear bombs. Natural disasters. Chemical and biological warfare. Without warning, the world as we know it can come to an end.
All right, everybody, welcome to Bottom Up Radio Network. But we ain't got no love for motherfucking pigs. I'm gonna let y'all jam out to some Rage Against the Motherfuckers right now. Thank you for tuning in tonight. Tonight we have a special guest host. We have the Stimulator coming in from Submedia TV, and he'll be joining us here in a little bit. So I'm going to be flying solo at first here because G20 Sided Die has a confirmed case of H1N1, and he got it from getting the vaccine. So he might be dead right now. We don't really know. But tonight, man, it's been last week was good. We had a guest host last week as it was our anniversary, so we were out celebrating our marriage to the state, and called in there towards the end, and it was a pretty decent show, so I want to say thank you to Reverend Dr. Mason Bilderberg for throwing down hard, and Mike Cannon for calling in, and everybody for listening in. But this is a whole new week, and we got a lot of shit to talk about this week, so I'm going to be taking calls anytime you want to call in during the show up until we get the Stimulator, and then we'll take calls at the appropriate time then. So the number to call in is 646-200-3974. Give a call if there's something you want to talk about, something you want to yell about. As for right now, I'm going to go ahead and introduce you to the Stimulator and his regular weekly broadcast he's been doing for a while now, called It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. I don't even know what to say about this program, man. I mean, this is the motherfucking shit. That's all I can say about it. So here it is. It's the End of the World, and I Feel Fine. Well, it was here. I guess it's not the end of the world yet. Is it the end of the world? Do you feel fine? I'm not feeling fine.
This episode of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine was made possible by contributions from slaves like you. Thank you very much.
He's a marketing dream. But like Calvin Klein or Benetton, he's a brand that promises something special. Something exciting, almost risque. as if he might be radical, as if he might enact change. He makes people feel good. He's a postmodern man with no political baggage, and all that's fake.
It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Good morning, slaves, and welcome to another edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, where elevating the discourse is our lowest priority. I am your host, The Stimulator, and the smackdown you just heard comes courtesy of John Pilger. And no, he was not making a eulogy for Jacko. Mr. Pilger is an Australian filmmaker who puts that fat fuck Michael Moore to shame. More recently, Mr. Pilger produced The War on Democracy, an in-depth look at the continued war that the pinche imperialista gringos y juega gran puta que los parió have been waging on my Latino brothers and sisters for more than a century. Let's hear a little more from that master of disaster.
During his brief period in the Senate, Obama voted to continue the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He voted for the Patriot Act. He refused to support a bill for single-payer health care. He supported the death penalty. He received more corporate backing than John McCain. He promised to close Guantanamo as a priority, but instead he's excused torture, reinstated military commissions, kept the Bush gulag intact, and opposed habeas corpus.
Oh, snack. This is just too fucking easy. Now, for most of you who watch the show religiously, none of this is new. But people are always asking me to provide them with tools to wake up their family and friends from their opium-induced buzz. Pilger's entire speech will be linked from my fucking website, stimulator.tv. Here's another little nugget.
In Colombia, he is planning to spend $46 million on a new military base that will support a regime backed by death squads and further the tragic history of Washington's intervention in that region.
It appears that that cock-nosed dick-fuck that your mama calls Obama is going to continue in the time-honored presidential tradition of shitting on Latin America. Obama and his crew are ramping up U.S. military presence in Colombia to supposedly fight drug cartels, but if our coke-sniffing president was really serious about fighting narco-traffic, he would simply dissolve the CIA.
Men who were working for the CIA's army were responsible for bringing all that cocaine into Los Angeles that sparked the crack epidemic.
President Obama, I want to express our gratitude again to you, to your cabinet, and to the United States.
That groveling suck-up is Colombian President Álvaro Uribe, who after residing in Obama's butthole, emerged with a promise of American military pilots, aircraft, and intelligence support. This deal will give the U.S. access to 7 military bases and a strategic presence for when they decide to take out Hugo, Evo, Rafael, and Fernando. You see, while George W. Bush was busy killing brown babies over in Iraq, my peeps down south were cleaning house and getting rid of the ruling classes that for years sucked Washington's cock and permitted the wholesale slaughter of any opposition to American imperialism. One of these cleaners is Ecuador's President Rafael Correa, who did not renew the lease of an Air Force base in the city of Manta. When asked why he did not want the Americans to rocket from Ecuador from now on, El Señor Correa responded,
Porque sí. Why renew it?
Mire, si quiere, yo lo renuevo con una condición.
Now, if you'd like, I would renew it with one condition.
Que me permitan poner una base militar ecuatoriana aquí en Nueva York.
That they allow me to set up an Ecuadorian military base here in New York.
Meanwhile, in Honduras, people have been hitting the streets nonstop to oppose the coup that forced democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya to flee the country. The motherfucking resistance has been met with hardcore police violence, including allegations of gang rapes, but the Obama administration remains mum on the issue. Also silent are the thousands of fuckheads who tweeted till their fingers bled during the disputed Iranian election. Or could it be that the puppet masters have already found a way to fuck with Twitter?
The use of Twitter is a very important one, not only to the Iranian people, but now increasingly to people around the world.
On the other side of the world, the annual climate camp descended on London, ground zero for global capitalism. Activists blocked the entrance of the carbon exchange to protest the commodification of the global warming gas in an action they called Climate Casino. The troublemakers are accusing the carbon traders with gambling with the planet's future.
For weeks, the city's been preparing for the G20 summit, a gathering of world leaders discussing the economic crisis And like previous summits, anarchists are expected to show up in large numbers.
Yep, it's that time again to make trouble for the 20 gangsters of the industrialized world. This time our so-called rulers will be descending upon Pittsburgh, but the motherfucking resistance will be there. Patrick Young of the Pittsburgh Organizing Group explains some of the reasons why we must oppose these evil capitalists.
They've created this bubble that has led to the worst financial crisis in our lifetimes, my lifetime and your lifetime. We're seeing unemployment go through the roof. We're seeing people across the country and around the world lose their homes.
But residents of the Steel City have other more sinister things to fear.
Protesters carrying gas masks and PCP pipes.
It has been a year since the combined clusterfucks of the Republican conventions in Denver and St. Paul East. The resistance accomplished much during these rebellions, and many were inspired by how far a little bit of good planning can go to cause big headaches to those in power. In Vancouver, where I live, corporatists have hijacked the city and are holding a big fiasco that they call the Winter Olympics. I call them
the Five Cochranes of Death.
A call-out has been issued for troublemakers of all stripes to come and oppose this festival of nationalism and corporate rule. But the tricky part is convincing y'all to oppose an event that's supposed to promote goodwill and sportsmanship. It's like asking someone to oppose Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. To dispel these myths of Olympic proportions, I bring you Gord Hill of Node2010.com and a member of the Olympic Resistance Movement. Hey Gord, how the fuck are you?
I'm doing good, thank you.
So, what the fuck are the Olympics?
The Olympics are a huge multi-billion dollar industry that's, you know, the governments and corporations working hand in hand to make more money and at the expense of the poor and the environment.
Is it true that there is a long history of fascism within the Olympics?
Yeah, if you look at the history of the modern Olympics, Avery Brundage, he was one of the most well-known Nazi sympathizers in the U.S. Olympic Committee, and he ended up becoming IOC president. Samaranch, who was one of the last long-term IOC presidents, he was a part of Franco's fascist regime in Spain. And then you had the Nazi Olympics where, you know, it basically bolstered the Nazi regime, and that's where they got the idea for the torch relay to promote Nazi fascism throughout Western Europe. And then you had the Mexico City Olympics where there was a massacre just days before the Olympic Games on the part of the Mexican government to ensure that there was a peace and order during the Olympic Games. You know, there was like over 300 people, mostly students, shot and killed by the Mexican military and police. And then you look at some of the other games as well, where they've allied themselves with the most authoritarian military regimes in Asia, the most recent one being Beijing, and then before that there was the South Korea, which was in the midst of a military dictatorship when they were awarded the games.
So are the Olympics a Trojan horse to insert fascism into Vancouver?
Yeah, I think if you look at the you know, the pattern of Olympic Games, these types of big mass spectacles, it's like a catalyst for social change in those areas where they set up. With the Olympics, you see the pattern of large scale restructuring of urban areas, which results in the relocation, the dislocation, the dispersal of poor, low income people and housing, especially. Then you have the establishment of a large security state to secure the games. which is usually large budgets for police and military. Some of the most recent games, like Athens and Beijing, you know, a huge security apparatus that was set up. 300,000 CCTV video cameras in Beijing, a whole network of informants, the same in Athens, the same in all the other cities that have held these games as well. The BC government and their corporate backers are looking at the Olympics as a means of opening up the province and the region to greater international investment, especially in certain industries like mining, oil and gas, and tourism. So that's why the ruling class of a city want the games to come in, because it acts as this kind of catalyst for economic development. And the police and that, they want it because it inflates their budgets and that. So you have this like little network of people, including people involved in land development, condos, these types of industry, that they're the ones who are on the bid committees, for example, who organize and compete with other cities to get the Olympic Games into their respective cities. So if you just look at who comprises the bid committees and the local organizing committees, you'll always find the same types of characters.
What the fuck is the Olympic Resistance Network?
The Olympic Resistance Network, or the ORN, is comprised of a number of different community, grassroots, political organizations that have organized themselves to oppose the Olympic Games.
The slogan for the ORN is, "No Olympics on Stolen Native Land." Just what the fuck does that mean?
Well, here in BC in particular, it refers to the history of colonialism here in the province and the lack of treaties that the government was required by its own laws to make in its western expansion across Canada. So if you go back to the British had put in place the 1763 Royal Proclamation after they had defeated France and they had to reorganize their North American colony. So the 1763 Royal Proclamation legally bound the British to make treaties as they expanded westward. And this is what they did. If you look at the history of Canada, you have these treaties, Treaty Number 1, Treaty Number 2, they're called the numbered treaties that encompass parts of Ontario and the provinces, you know, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta. Vast tracts of land that were ceded in these treaties in exchange for, food and stuff like this. So when they got to BC, which was just forming itself as a colony at that time under the British, they started to make treaties. The first ones are known as the Douglas Treaties, after the first governor. And he made a number of small treaties on Vancouver Island. And then after that, they just stopped the process and just imposed government control over all these indigenous lands here in the province. So when we say there's no Olympics on stolen native land, it's to raise people's awareness and consciousness about this history, about the lack of treaties, and which really challenges the legal basis for the governments here in the province, because what we're saying is like it's illegal and it's actually immoral, because they were bound by their own laws to make treaties before they settled on any land or any business took place on sovereign indigenous lands.
What future actions are planned to disrupt this bullshit?
So the Olympic torch relay is going to begin October 30th, and it's going to start from Victoria. Then it's going to travel up Vancouver Island, and then it's going to go up into northern Canada and cross over to the east coast, and then start again on land and cross over back to Vancouver for February 12th, 2010. It's one of the largest land torch relays, one of the longest in the Olympic history, and so we are organizing to disrupt the torch relay, beginning with its send-off in Victoria, and we're calling on people in other communities where the relay passes through to also challenge it, oppose it, disrupt it if possible. Most recently, representatives from the four host First Nations, which are the Native Collaborator Sellouts, we're in Six Nations, Ontario, trying to gather support for the torch relay passing through that community, and they were challenged there also by an indigenous comrades there. So we're hoping that as in 2008, when the international torch relay was being conducted for China, the Beijing Games, it was massively disrupted because of China's invasion of Tibet at that time, the violence that was occurring there. But we're hoping to disrupt the torch relay based on the same kind of principles, anti-colonial, anti-capitalist resistance.
Thanks, Gord. And that about does it for this edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. The following slaves chipped in to help fund this edition: Christine, Cillian, Michael, Kim, Weston, and Stuart. Kopupa. To comment on this show or for links on the Olympic resistance, just visit my fucking website, stimulator.tv. Now, go get yourself a super soaker.
Remember, kids, you can podcast high-quality video of this show at submedia.tv.
So that's the Stimulator show. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. That was this most recent episode called Super Soak the Olympics. If you want to see that with video, go to stimulator.tv or go to submedia.tv, and you can see it on there. The videos are quite great. It's a really classy show. It's done really well, and it just speaks volumes for how creative we in the anarchist community can be if we choose to use the weapons that the master has unwittingly provided us, such as the fucking interwebs. It's a pretty interesting bit of discussion we've had around these parts since we had Derek Jensen on the show, and we've been talking more and more about bringing down civilization and with friends and strangers. And it's interesting to get the responses that you get, specifically when posting about these things on the on the internet, using your Facebook or whatever it is that you, whatever social networking tool it is that you're using to put these ideas out there, it's interesting to see how people come out of the woodwork to voice their opposition to resistance, even when they claim to be somehow fighting for the rights of others, and it tends to be the Obama supporting liberals who call themselves environmentalists because they use fluorescent light bulbs. It's fucking sick and ridiculous. And, you know, so if you want to find a way to piss them off, just start throwing some facts in their faces that are undeniable facts about just how civilization itself is a threat to all existing life. When talking about the healthcare bill, this is a really, really funny subject to talk about, because instantly if you start to criticize the healthcare bill, you're instantly lumped into being somehow connected with right-wing nutcases who are doing tea parties and all the other shit that these poor and middle-class white people who think that they owe the boss something are out fighting for. I don't know how I feel about them. I really don't care. It's pretty interesting to see, you know, that 1.2 million people showed up in the Capitol building a couple of days ago. I don't know how I feel about what they're fighting for, but I do enjoy the fact that they are standing up to fight. Now, if they were going to win and they were trying to enact some more fucked up policies, which of course they would, then we would have to take them down just as quickly. But it's interesting to get lumped into the category of being a right-wing nutbag or a right-wing conspiracy theorist when you talk about things like the Rockefellers, which, you know, it's not a conspiracy theory. That is a real family who are doing really fucked up things for the last 100 years at least, and getting away with it and getting rich off of it. So fuck them, period. There is no redeeming qualities to anybody in that level of power. Whether you believe it's a conspiracy theory or not is your problem, not mine. But these liberals on Facebook, man, the Facebook liberals, they crack me up the most. They want to talk about peace, and they want to talk about shunning all violent forms of you know, democracy, as they would call it. Resistance is what I would say. And they want to shun all forms of violence, yet they don't want to stop the war machine. They want to keep the president in power that promises them war, even if we want to go by the idea that this power structure somehow works for the people and can be shifted by the people, which I think we've seen clearly that it is not run by the people or for the people, and it cannot be shifted by or for the people within the means of the system, i.e. voting, boycotts, etc. It must be brought down in a whole different manner, but that's for another discussion. Even if we were to buy into those ideas, these people are still not taking the necessary steps within their own system to create the changes that are needed. For instance, they will gladly applaud when a shoe is thrown at George W. Bush, and why not? That's funny shit. I enjoyed the shit out of seeing that shoe get thrown at Bush repeatedly. But then as soon as someone speaks out against Obama, they're all of a sudden out of line, and they must be crazy. They're a wingnut. Joe Wilson screams out two words, and all of a sudden he's some antichrist. I don't give a shit about Joe Wilson, but give me a fucking break, people. If we can't stand up to power, and no matter what your beliefs are, without being shunned by all the slaves of that master, then we got a real problem here. We got a real problem, and it's going to require a whole different outlook and a whole different plan to deal with this, because we can't wait any longer for a mass movement. It's not going to happen. We don't have the resources nor the lack of conscience to do what it takes to bring together a mass movement of people. We're not Fox News, and we're not ABC. We're not the liberal or the right-wing media. We don't have that kind of power, nor do we have the patience that is warranted, because we understand how immediate this change must come, and it's got to come soon. It's got to come really soon. So I guess that's going to be up to everybody now at this point. The responsibility has been shifted away from the leaders to the rabble, and we got to see what we're going to do with it. On another note, I'm going to go ahead and, since I'm not receiving any calls, if anybody wants to call in, the line is open, 646-200-3974. Give me a ring here at Burn, and let's see what you want to talk about this week. We got about a half hour or so before we expect the stimulator to call in. So, instead of me sitting here ranting, how about a free commercial?
Be ruthless, take risks, vandalize only what must be defaced, do something children will remember all their lives, but don't be spontaneous, unless the poetic terrorist muse has possessed you. Dress up, leave a false name, be legendary. The best poetic terrorism is against the law, but don't get caught. Art as crime, crime as art.
All right, that's a free commercial sent to us by the Rev. Dr. Mason Bilderberg. And I'm going to play one quick clip. Now, this is ripped straight from the mainstream media, and this is what makes this even more interesting to me. This is from the Scarborough Country Report on MSNBC from a couple years ago. Take it or leave it for what you will. But sometimes some segments of truth do come through, and I'm not sure if it's power testing us to see if we're paying attention or testing to see if their mind control tactics are working, and we're working so well that we'll even ignore when they tell us that they're going to kill us. Who knows? But this is in particular about the company Bayer, who makes Bayer aspirin, owned by an umbrella company called Baxter. Baxter and Bayer is synonymous with one another, and this company received all of the American contracts for the H1N1 vaccination. Here we go.
Operation, the rat of the week. Internal documents show that after this company positively, absolutely knew that they had a medication that was infected with the AIDS virus, they took the product off the market in the U.S. and then they dumped it in France, Europe, Asia, and Latin America. The medicine's called Factor VIII. It was an injection medicine that was used for hemophiliacs, mostly children. Children had been born with an incurable
disease.
Hold on, Mike.
So you're telling me that Bayer knew that this drug was infected with the AIDS virus. They yanked it from the market in America, and then they dumped it in markets overseas. They had to figure out a way, Joe, to make a profit on a product that they could not sell in America.
So there it is. That's the company who's going to be shooting you in the arm this fall. They're promising vaccinations by mid-October at this point. And don't worry, they just discovered that instead of getting two shots, that they can probably shoot you up with enough dope to take care of all of your woes of living in just one shot. So you're only going to get one little mark on your arm. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but I am going to say that there's no fucking way in hell that that shot is going to come near me or any of my family, and I'll be goddamned excited to see what's going to happen when they try, because it's just not going to fly. But on to some more. Well, actually, let's discuss this vaccination thing for a second. I like to get information directly from the mouth of the demon. And Dr. J. Anthony Morris, you can look him up. He was the former chief vaccine control officer and research virologist for the U.S. FDA. This is an exact direct quote from his mouth. There is a great deal of evidence to prove that immunization of children does more harm than good. Well, did you know, then, that between 1989 and 1999, vaccinations grew from 10 vaccines on the list for children up to 36, and that was 10 years ago. At this point, it's even higher. The amount of chemicals and doping that we're putting into our children, is no wonder that we have such high rates of autism, false diseases such as ADHD and overweight, youth onset diabetes. We're talking about a ridiculous amount of diseases. I'm sure the list is too long to even read off, let alone me to memorize. But I do know that something is not fucking right. And if you trust your government, that's fine. Go ahead, trust them. Go with the Obamacare healthcare plan and take their dope. Soma, a gram a day keeps the blues away. So right now, I'm going to play for you a clip that is from the upcoming film In Civ, which is directed and written by the Stimulator, who's going to be our guest later. I'm going to play one of the clips from that, and then we'll play another one a little bit later. This is going to give you an idea of what we're going to be talking about tonight. So I hope you enjoy this clip.
If Nazis or other fascists took over North America, what would we all do? What would we do if they implemented Mussolini's definition of fascism? Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it's a merger of state and corporate power.
I'm going to pause that for a second and talk about that for just one moment. What would we do if they implemented Mussolini's definition of fascism, the merger of state and corporate power? Well, on September 9th, Obama gave what some people are calling one of his greatest speeches to date about the healthcare initiatives that he's putting forward. And one of the things that he says is that they're not going to do a government option. They're going to do a public option to buy into private healthcare, meaning that everybody will be able to buy healthcare either through government grants or tax credits, buy into privatized healthcare. Now, what he followed that with was that every American will have to have healthcare by law, just like auto insurance. Everybody will have to have it. If you want to use a car, you have to have auto insurance. If you want to live, you have to have health insurance, meaning that they're merging state power to regulate laws with corporate power in the privatization of yet another corporation's sick and twisted ideas of profit over people. So they are enacting Mussolini's definition of fascism. But, I might just be a right-wing conspiracy theorist.
What if this occupied country called itself a democracy, but most everyone understood elections to be shams? With citizens allowed to choose between different wings of the same fascist, following Mussolini's corporate party. What if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Would you fight back? If there already existed a resistance movement, would you join it? Would you resist if the fascists irradiated the countryside, poisoned food supplies, made rivers unfit for swimming, and so filthy you wouldn't even dream of drinking from them anymore? If fascists systematically deforested the continent, would you join an underground army of resistance, head to the forests, and from there to boardrooms in the halls of the Reichstag to pick off the occupying deforesters, and most especially those who give them the marching orders? Give me a threshold. Give me a specific point at which you finally take a stand. If you can't or won't give that threshold, why not?
So check out ncivv.com. That's ENDCIV.com. I'm going to throw that link into the chat room right now. And I want you to go there and check it out. This is the film that's being made. Now, I do believe that Stimulator has placed a donate button on his sites, so you can donate to help assist with the production of this film. This is what we in the anarchist world call mutual aid. So if you have the time and a few extra dollars, everything would help. And just shoot him some money over the PayPal system there. And you'll be helping this film that looks really awesome so far to come into completion and ready for distribution. So check it out, ncivv.com, and let us know what you think. So I'm not receiving any phone calls so far. I'm going to go ahead and play a song, and we're going to take it easy tonight. Let's see. There we go. This is David Rovix with his song, the Pirate Radio song, and David's going to be coming around the Missouri area on October 3rd. He'll be playing at Webster University at an event called Get the Folk Up Fest. Sorry, I was brain farting. So check it out there. Al Baker will be playing that, as well as the Reunited Holy, Holy, Holy. And that's on October 3rd at Webster University campus. I believe it starts sometime around noon. And it goes all day. And then that evening afterwards, we'll be playing the film Fresh at the Franklin House in St. Charles, Missouri for free. So check those out. But here's David Rovix.
This is how it started. It's not hard to understand. From coast to coast, they're lying at a CEO's command. From Nationalist Public Radio, CNN and NBC, Big Brother spewing propaganda from the Disinformation Ministry. They say the economy is booming. We hear the homeless beggars cry. They say we help poor countries. We see bombs falling from the skies. Reality doesn't exist, they're trying to say. But some of us decided there is another way. Seize the airwaves, seize the time. 'Cause lying to the people is the real crime. When it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word, we will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. Someone got a transmitter, started up a station. Then the idea spread right across the nation. Like the land and water, the air must be free. So let us shout together, fuck the FCC. Seize the airwaves, seize the time. 'Cause lying to the people is the real crime. When it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word, we will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. And we'll do it all together in a grassroots style, tearing down the fences throughout this whole square mile. It's the new town meeting, it's the way the news should be. The rulers call it chaos, we say it's democracy. So when you turn on the radio and you've had it with this shit, from 88 to 107 makes you wanna have a fit. When you listen to the music and it's all the same pop song, start up a pirate station, 'cause that's where you belong. Seize the airwaves, seize the time. 'Cause lying to the people is the real crime. When it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word, we will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. Seize the airwaves, seize the time. 'Cause lying to the people is the real crime. When it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word, we will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard.
All right, so that's David Rovix with the Pirate Radio song. You can get that for free on soundclick.com/David Rovix, along with about 210 other of his songs. I've got a special guest that we're getting ready to interview right here on Bottom Up Radio Network. This is one of the most badass revolutionaries that I know, and I'll just let him introduce himself. Why don't you tell the people who you are?
I'm Whitman.
So, Whitman, what do you do?
I like playing songs.
What else?
I like playing with my brother.
Anything else?
Yeah, I like reading books.
So you like playing songs, playing with your non-existent brother, and reading books. That sounds really fun, man. Let me ask you, if you were to confront the state, what would you do to the state?
I'll smash it.
So, you would smash the state. Well, that sounds interesting. Exactly how would you go about smashing the state? What would you do to smash the state?
Like, get a big knife and smash it.
Big knife? Do you think you would vote about it?
I will.
You will? Would you take consensus?
No.
No? You would not take consensus on this. You would act on your own and smash the state.
Yes, I will.
Well, that sounds like a heck of a time, man. So what do you got plans in the future here, Whitman? What's happening? What's going on in your life? Give us all a breakdown of what you got going on a daily basis. What's new with you?
I like Spider-Man. That's all that's happening.
Well, that sounds pretty intriguing in and of itself. Well, that's good. Everybody, that's my son Whitman, and he is a badass. Whitman, are you enjoying unschooling?
No.
No? You don't like unschooling?
I do like unschooling.
Oh, you do like unschooling. Was the question confusing?
No.
All right, well, why don't you give us a send-off here, Whitman. Say goodbye to all the people out there in Bottom Up Radio Network land.
We have to do that.
Say take care, everybody. See you later.
See you later.
Thanks so much, Whitman, for being on the show. Whitman, you want to pick a song for us to play on the show right now? Whitman, are you uninterested? You want to pick a song?
Yeah.
Here's all the songs. Let's see. What about... What about this one? It's Immortal Techniques, Point of No Return. That's the hip-hop.
Can we go more down?
Let's go more down? Okay.
More down, guys.
That's called Turn Off Your Radio by the Pizza Boys.
Let's do it.
All right, everybody, this is the Pizza Boys, Turn Off Your Radio, picked by your guest host, Whitman, the Burninator.
We urge you calmly, but sincerely, to turn off your radio now.
Cornelius McGrath, 17th Reach, the Cinema Guru, John Shit. Take him on and off, it's not worth it. Ain't gonna look on it like a dead shit. Will Shank on Green Town, I love the freak. Throw Jack, Pennsylvania. But your shot, sick, sharp shit. Diedrich just don't got crazy. But your shot, sick, sharp shit. New Guinea to the mid, don't speak like. Back on shore, in short tongue shot. Got an island off full night. But this part, it's over. Part one, two, love, half, bitter, brother. Take your neck, a boxer of the shitter. Short, it's deep, and red. It's cold, and blue. And they got it when they dead down. Lucky monkey, cousin, your miss, barrel on you. It's true. Lucky monkey, cousin, your miss, barrel on you. It's true. Bones of King Herod and the blood of Dante. Mickey, Jackie, Ace, no, so elegante. See me biting off sides, chicken heads like Ave. I'm a homie, I'm a drumgita, in order to throw the party. Bloody bastard, say, get the fuck out my way. We unfadable, baby. Go for it, dude, and I don't mean maybe. Fuck Masonic temples, I run that shit. wanna join a little game? Fuck that shit. It's all out in the house. It's God in the crib. And it don't stop. And it don't quit. Peace on the boys who keep your belly fed. Have a slice of pizza. Take it to the head. Brush your little teeth. Make a little bed. That's what I said. Boy, that's what I said. Just today you're here. And tomorrow you're dead.
All right, we had a near takeover in the studio here. We almost had Whitman almost took over the show. He was trying to tie me up and place me into a trunk of some sort, and he was going to take over the studio and play Pizza Boys songs all night. But no, I say, no, that cannot occur. There's way too much important shit to do on the air tonight. Actually, there's really not that much important shit to do on the air tonight. It's a really nice night outside, so I think I might mosey on that way and grab something. In the meantime, I'm going to go ahead and get this going. And at the end of this break here, it's about an 11-minute break, we'll be at the top of the hour and leading into the last hour of the show, where we will be being joined by the Stimulator, supposing everything goes well. So right now, this is Mike Cannon's This Week in Radical History. And we already played that one. Uh-oh, we've got problems here on the home front. I can't seem to find Rad History for this week. Well, let's think quick. Boom. This is the beauty of the internet. I'll just tell you what I'm doing so you can do it yourself. I'm going to radio4all.net. That's R-A-D-I-O, number 4, A-L-L.net. And there's a lot of great programs on this site. The one I'm searching right now is This Week in Radical History. This is a show that's been played by Mike Cannon for over a year now. He just celebrated his 1 year getting through all the days for every week of the year. And this is This Week in Radical History for the week of September 14th. Take it away, Mr. Cannon.
Next time President Obama addresses America's school children, he has to tell them they're obese and that they should get off drugs, or otherwise they'll grow up to be Rush Limbaugh. From the Mobile Fortress of Glee Glee Studios, you're about to hear This Week in Radical History for the week starting September 14th. Inspiration for the segment came from the Slingshot organizer, and more radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Glee website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
Hey! This Week in Radical History for September 15th, 1845. The first mass strike of women workers for a 10-hour workday took place when 5,000 women in textile mills in Pennsylvania walked off the job. The strike, however, was unsuccessful. Also on September 15th, 1923, Ku Klux Klan activities in Oklahoma reaches such a high pitch that the governor is forced to declare a state of rebellion and insurrection. History seems to be more than willing to repeat itself as the modern-day KKK, known as neo-Nazi skinheads, are rearing its ugly heads in both the South, but also skinhead strongholds like parts of New Jersey. Also on September 15, 1970, Tricky Dick Nixon orders the CIA to prevent the inauguration of Salvador Allende, a democratically elected president of Chile. They didn't succeed, however. The trickster further authorizes $250,000 to bribe Chilean congressmen. 3 years later, in 1973, folk singer Victor Jara is murdered in a massacre after the U.S.-sponsored overthrow of Allende is started. A quote from a Chilean housewife found in the New York Times at the time stated, "Allende's biggest mistake was not giving us weapons. A lot of people, even women, would have fought." The CIA is instrumental in Allende's murder and installing dictator Pinochet, who's responsible for tens of thousands of deaths, most native indigenous darker Chileans, who were in a continuous struggle against the lighter Spanish immigrants who took the lands. Like most of these proxy wars, it really is a struggle about indigenous versus the conquest of their lands. This week in Radical History for September 16, 1915 in Haiti, U.S. takes control of customs and finance of Haiti for 10 years to protect U.S. plundering interests, I'm sure, and the country becomes bankrupt, once one of the richest countries in this hemisphere. Also on September 16, 1920, in revenge of the prosecution of Sacco and Vassetti, thousands take to the street in dozens of countries around the world. Propaganda the Deed anarchist Mario Buda detonates a horse and buggy bomb at the corner wall on Broad Street in Manhattan in retaliation for Sacco and Vassetti's deaths. The bomb explodes outside the J.P. Morgan Company in New York's Wall Street, causes $2 million worth of damage, and the ensuing fire would destroy Morgan's offices. The Sebra and Shatila massacre happened on this date in 1982, when Israeli Defense Forces, whose General Ariel Sharon is in charge of the Palestinian concentration camp set up by Israel on the border with Lebanon. Sharon would allow the Lebanese faction to enter the camp with arms, massacring perhaps more than 3,500 unarmed Palestinians. That is why, among many other outrages by the Israeli government and members of the Israeli government, why many of them are considered war criminals by many in the Middle East. Though we've invaded Iraq for violating 17 UN resolutions, Israel is in violation of over 40 UN resolutions about their handling of the longest occupation in modern history, the Palestinian occupation. Yet no matter what UN resolutions Israel violates, they get a free pass every time. A free pass to kill, a free pass to occupy, a free pass to demolish homes, a free pass to do whatever they want to the Palestinian people. This week in Radical History for September 17, 1179, medieval proto-feminist, mystic, poetic visionary, and composer Hildegard of Bingen dies on this date. Known for many things, including some of the music you're hearing in the background right now, eight of the original compositions have survived to this date. Hildegard's visionary writing maintained that virginity is the highest level of spiritual life. However, she also wrote about the secular life, including motherhood. She's the first woman to record a treatise on female sexuality, providing scientific accounts of female orgasms. As a side note, I suspect the 12th century Hildegard would be considered too radical for certain Alaskan governors' sensibilities. More sad news for September 17th, 1973 in Chile. At noon today, word had come down that Americans were missing. David Hathaway had been taken from his apartment. Frank Tertugi, American IWW member and journalist, was also unaccounted for. And sometime during that day, Charlie Horman would also be seized. Here's just some of what we know about the U.S. involvement in the disappearance and execution of Americans. Pinochet may have CIA go-ahead to kill Americans, documents show The Guardian. Though Chilean authorities never confirmed that Mr. Tertugi was executed, he was arrested in the apartment days after the coup and tortured at the National Stadium, witnesses said. His body was discovered in a morgue 10 days later, riddled with bullet holes. Quote, FBI watched an American who was killed in Chile coup, New York Times.
And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. What may be difficult to accept is that there's nothing new about that. In fact, it's what we hire our Secretary of State and our Foreign Service to do for us. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality.
This week in Radical History for September 18th, only got two items. 1838, under the forced removal order of Indiana, the Potawatomi are delivered to the ironically named Immigrant Agency concentration camps. Also on September 18, 1934, textile workers are out on strike on the East Coast. In all, 1.5 million workers strike in different industries in 1934. A broad anti-war movement is organized in college campuses as well. A nationwide strike against the war in 1934 drew some 25,000 students, whereas a strike in 1936 turned out an estimated 500,000 students.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
Week in Radical History for September 19th. I only have two items. 1776, George Washington's farewell address. He strongly warns against permanent alliances with foreign powers, large public debt, large military establishment, and devices of any small, artful, enterprising minority to control or change the government. Also on this date, 1856, U.S. forces invade Panama to protect American interests. To this date, the U.S. has over 700 military bases around the world. All protecting American interests, of course. Guess how many foreign military bases are on our soils? Two more items for this week in Radical History for September 20th, 1934. Southern employers continue their big counteroffensive to break the textile labor strike. 10,000 National Guardsmen mobilize, supplemented by 15,000 armed deputies, in an effort to stampede some 421,000 strikers and to force them back to work. Also on that date in 1974, Kutene Nation in northern Idaho declares war on U.S. government with the objective of gaining reservation and tribal housing, roads, and community centers denied to them since the taking of their lands by the U.S. and Canadian governments, whose borders go through the Kutene Nation's lands. This has been This Week in Radical History. This week's ending song is by a New York band called Violet Crush with the song Burn Down Hot Topic. Until next week, this reminder that I'm always and forever yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
Before this song plays, I want to dedicate this song to my friend Rob, who just got fired after putting in a few years of work at Hot Topic as a manager. And oddly enough, they're firing him instead of giving him a raise and using a bullshit claim of sexual harassment when he said that he was going to go home. And, well, I'm not even going to say what he said. He didn't say anything bad at all. But fuck Hot Topic.
We all go a little mad sometimes. talk about this, and you will be kind.
All right, so that's This Week in Radical History for the week of September 14th. Hope you all are digging what Mike Cannon is doing, because he puts a lot of hard work into that for absolutely no financial reimbursement whatsoever, and that's what we all do, because fuck money. But I got a phone call now, so I'm going to take it. Hello.
Hello.
Who the fuck is this?
How the fuck are you?
I think I know who this is by that one single question. I'm on top of the fucking world. How the fuck are you? It's my show now. I get to ask the questions. How the fuck are you, Simulator?
I'm fucking tired and I'm fucking thirsty, and I just got back from the motherfucking Victoria Anarchist Book Fair and Festival of Anarchy, and I'm energized even though I feel tired and kind of out of it. But hopefully you will burn all that shit out and squeeze some truth out of me.
Clever, burn the shit out. I like that. Throwing the name of the show into it.
Oh, did I just do that? Oh.
Well, the show's name is Burn, so.
I know. I'm just fucking with you.
Now I'm getting fucked with. This is great. So, you don't drink coffee, right? Isn't that what I hear?
No, man. That is something that I tried for a while, but it didn't quite work out. And I think that this weekend I was trying to stay awake because, we did a big event here in Vancouver for the Olympic Resistance Network, and I was going on very little sleep, and all I did this weekend was drink coffee to survive.
Well, I guess if it's for revolutionary survival, then you really can't argue the aspects of drinking the coffee, right?
Right.
I'm drinking coffee right now, so, and I live
absolutely
in Missouri. We don't grow coffee here.
No, you know, that's really sucky. I mean, there's something called the Kentucky coffee tree that grows, that can actually even grow up here in Vancouver, but I heard the coffee that comes out of it is terrible, so.
Yeah, we get chicory here. We have a lot of chicory that grows wild, actually. Do you know about chicory?
Isn't that what the Mormons drink?
I don't know. I didn't know the Mormons drank anything. I thought they were some kind of lizard people like David Icke always talks about.
The Mormons are not supposed to drink coffee, so I thought that that was their coffee substitute was chicory.
It might be. The cool history of chicory is in the South during the war, the military was taking over people's stores, taking stock of all of their wares and using them for military purposes. And so some Southern farmers got together and hid their coffee stocks. And they cut them in half and halved it with chicory to add it to the appearance of how much coffee they had. That way the military couldn't take over all of their coffee. So they hid half of it and substituted the other half with chicory. And that's why chicory coffee became so famous in the South, because people actually grew accustomed to liking the taste of it. And it comes from wildflowers, that dandelions, actually, that grow up everywhere, that people tend to pull out of their yard and think are some kind of a weed, was actually used as a tool of resistance to keep the state from occupying all of your goods.
Sneaky,
kind of
sneaky.
A cool story. Yeah, I like
it. Yeah. So you like chicory?
Well, I like it. I like it sometimes. I like it with some donuts or something like that. I mean, it's more of a sentimental thing than it is actually liking chicory. Yeah, it's one of those things. I don't fucking know. Why we do what we do. I question sometimes whether or not I actually know what I like anymore. I don't know what my desires are or if they've been force-fed to me since birth. You know, who fucking knows?
Yeah, really. Like, I grew up in Puerto Rico, and I never drank coffee. And I left Puerto Rico when I was 17. But coffee in Puerto Rico is fucking amazing. And, like, it was not until after I dropped out of college and all that I actually started getting into coffee. And now
what's
I'm like,
the,
I wish I...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, there's a Cafe Bustelo. That's a Puerto Rican thing.
You know what? Cafe Bustelo is it's coffee that's been processed to the Puerto Rican and Cuban taste. But I believe that most of that coffee comes from Colombia. Because for Puerto Rico... produces just enough coffee to satisfy local demand. They don't make enough for to be able to export. So
interesting,
you see,
concept.
Yeah, exactly. So most people in the even when I lived in New York City, they had the Puerto Rican brands, but it was like it would say Puerto Rican style coffee.
Right.
It didn't really mean that it was Puerto Rican coffee. It just means that the way it was toasted or whatever, it was something Puerto Rican, like, but it wasn't the same, because the Puerto Rican coffee doesn't have a lot of acidity. It's very, very smooth, and it's yeah. And you can mail order it, but you know.
That's kind of like when I used to get my Coke from Mexico that was Colombian style cocaine, but it wasn't. You could tell. That's a joke.
Oh, really? It took me a second. Snap.
No, yeah. But actually, this is an interesting little stream that we're on here about locality and remaining local with your consumption and your resistance, which is something that a lot of us are talking about now, both on both aspects, consuming locally and resisting locally. And
right.
You are in the fucking belly of the beast right now, my friend. Can you talk about what you guys were talking about at the book fair there with the 2010 and all that shit?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is, I don't know if this is my problem, but this will be the second Olympic city that I've resided in. I used to live in Atlanta as well. And the Olympics...
plant. The Olympics just follow you around. This is bullshit.
What the fuck, right? Well, you know what? Like back in 96 when the Atlanta Olympics were happening, I had no idea about the evilness of it all. You know, but at the same time, you heard these stories, right, that, oh, they took the homeless people from downtown Atlanta and they put them on a bus and they drove them 50 miles outside of the city and said peace. And, you know, that happened. And that happened in Atlanta for every major big sporting event to happen, the Super Bowl, the All-Star Game.
Absolutely.
And
it happened in Denver at the DNC. There was a group of homeless advocates in Denver who were walking around trying to educate people about the 11,000 homeless people that disappeared in the weeks leading up to the DNC.
Yeah, well, you know, I believe it, and you know, the homeless are to a certain degree like nature, like it's some living beings that really have no voice, and they need people like us to kind of help speak for them, you know, or at least give them the megaphone so they can actually speak for themselves, because nobody takes them seriously. And when they complain, it's just really hard for them to get their message out there. And really fucked up shit things are being done to them. And I think that the main problem is that people make assumptions about who the homeless are. And we're a really fucking judgmental society. We have no fucking idea what people have gone through to get to where they are.
Well,
and,
I don't think it's necessarily fair to say that people make assumptions. I think people are told lies, period. I mean, you know, it goes back to that question of, do we really know what we want? Well, I mean, we've been told who homeless people are without knowing. You know, like, you talk to most people and they'll see homeless people, but they don't know who they are. They don't talk to them ever. And so it's not like they're making an assumption necessarily as they are going by what they've been taught.
True that. True that.
And that's the same thing with nature.
I'm sorry?
It applies to nature as well. You know, people are scared of nature. They're absolutely
right.
Fucking death of it.
That's the truth. Well, you know, not to kind of go off topic here, but I'm gonna give my spiel on the Olympics. So here it goes.
Go.
2010, if you have the means, if it's not going to take you away from your local struggle, if you have, if you can hop a train, if you have rain gear, if you can camp, if you have skills for making life hell for these fucking capitalists that are coming to Vancouver, come and help us resist this occupation of armies of corporations that are going to take over our city and they're going to militarize our city for a 2-week period and beyond, and are going to displace the homeless. They'll already cause lots of destruction to the environment with the creations of new highways, destruction of natural habitats for eagles and other things, and also further encroaching into unceded Aboriginal territory. I mean, if you really want to talk about fascism in disguise. The Olympics is it. I mean, this is a brilliant way of to basically create a Trojan horse to introduce these types of fascistic policies into a city in Vancouver. It's a living example, and I see it, everything's changing here so fast, I can't even tell you.
Wow. So what is the local resistance there looking like then? I mean, I know that that there has to be a strong contingency of indigenous peoples. One thing that a lot of Americans, U.S. Americans, I should say, not just Americans, because you know, North America, everybody's an American in North America, but United States Americans don't quite understand the amount of indigenous natives of the Canadian regions. When you think of Canada, you just think of people that can't pronounce the word about. You don't think about that. You know, tell us about that a little bit, because I know that there's some spiritual resistance going on for the land there that is highly important to the native peoples of the region.
Well, you know, I could tell you one thing. My education about Native folks all over America was really, like, you know, it really came together when I moved to Vancouver, because the activists here have made it very they have made it their mission to, anytime there's an event, anytime there's some sort of speaker, anytime anything happens, they'll tell you, oh, well, we're first going to acknowledge on whose land we are. And that's how anything single event or any single political action kind of starts here. And one of the things that I've come to learn is also, like, just mostly a reminder is that, you know, we're all settlers here in one way or another. You know, we're not necessarily guests in somebody's land, because I don't think a lot of these folks really wanted us here. And so that's one of the things that the Olympic resistance is trying to bring to light more than anything, is that there were no real treaties made between the settlers of British Columbia and the folks who the many different peoples that inhabit this beautiful, beautiful piece of the world. And I think it's high time that we start to acknowledge that, and we start to figure out a way to fix that, and also start to learn how these folks, for more than 10,000 years, have been able to manage, quote unquote, natural resources in a sustainable way. You know, I mean, it is this weird thing. Like the Olympics have kind of given us a great avenue to showcase something that could be such a powerful piece of information, not only that these lands are stolen, but also that we can learn so much from these folks, and that our systematic destruction of their culture might be our own demise, because their way of living might be the key to the salvation of the world. Yet I remain pretty pessimistic, but that sounded kind of good at the moment, so I'll shut up.
Well, you know, it goes along with what Derek Jensen says at the end of that amazing fucking manifesto, Endgame. At the end of Volume 2, he talks about working with many indigenous cultures, many natives, and he said that one thing that kind of rings clearly across the board with all of these groups is they all say, no, we're not going to teach you how to resist. We're not going to teach you how to bring down civilization, because if we taught you how to survive without that, you would capitalize upon it. However, once civilization falls, we'll gladly teach you how to survive, and we'll gladly teach you the native ways. You know, it's like, now I'm not going to tell you how to kill the cop, but once the cop's dead, I'll tell you how to be free. You know, and it's pretty interesting.
That is so true, and you know, I think that yeah, true. Like the moment you teach somebody a cool way to do something, they think, well, at least, like in our culture, as Derek Jensen puts it, we think, like, there's got to be a way I can make money out of this.
Right, exactly. I've heard that so many fucking times, man. About anything creative that we come up with in just our little collective in our small town, somebody will come over and say, wow, you know, you could really market this. You could really come up with this, you know. You could make a living. And then I say, fuck that, fuck money. And they're like, well, you got to make a living, man. You know, I mean, you got to make some money somehow. I just don't fucking get that, man. Isn't the idea to be working our ass off to get away from having to, quote, make a living? I mean, you live a living. You make a fucking table. You know, I just don't understand where this idea comes in that you have to figure out a way to make money off of fucking everything, or anything for that matter.
Yeah, that is the truth. That is the truth. Well, you know, and that's I think, I mean, I guess we're speaking to, we're preaching to the converted here, right? So I just kind of sound stupid saying this, but that's, you know, that's really the crux of the issue, right? Fucking capitalizing, putting a price on everything. It just drives me insane. But you know what? Like, if you were born in this century, that's all you know, right? So it's just something that we have to unlearn.
And yeah, but we also know one thing about capitalism, living as anarchists in the underground, and it's not something that's inherently anarchists that know this, but capitalism brings about a plentiful bounty of things to be stolen, because they're already stolen. And that's one thing that we need to really start stressing. I've been talking about this a lot with the healthcare. People need to learn the history of radical resistance and uprisings, true bottom-up uprisings. You know, fucking Obama uses that phrase, and it was laughable when he would use the term bottom-up. But people in past times, when things were struggling, when things were hard, they would provide free healthcare in their community. Doctors would provide free healthcare to striking workers. Doctors would provide free healthcare to travelers. You know, during the Great Depression, during the Dust Bowls, when all the farmers were migratory, doctors would provide absolutely free of charge healthcare to people because they fucking need it. And now we have these liberal Democrats out here charging that, you know, we have to support Obama in this bullshit fascist plan of supporting the corporatocracy. Just so we can stay alive. I think it's ridiculous. I think people need to learn that those hospitals are full of medical supplies. And all it takes is a few doctors and a few nurses on the inside to make the fucking difference. You know, one hospital being occupied could change the outlook of the entire healthcare fucking debate, period.
And absolutely.
I don't
think absolutely.
Sure, you know, I mean, you could say the same thing about the 2010 resistance. I mean, looking back to, like, to Tommy Smith in 1968, and I think his name was John Carlos, the two Olympic athletes who donned a black glove and raised their fist in the 68 Olympics, you know, to stand in solidarity with all of their black freedom fighters that were fighting, who didn't have the privilege of being in the Olympic Stadium in Mexico City.
Not only that, but there had been a massacre just like a week or weeks before that. Where all these protesters were massacred in Mexico City by the Mexican army and the Mexican police, and that's something that the Olympic, you know, the Olympic machine tried to cover up, you know, and it's interesting to note that those athletes who raised their fists lost their medals. So you know, that's something that you know, we see the photos and we're inspired, but we have to know that at the time the fascist regime of the of that constituted the Olympics did not want to encourage anybody to make any political statements during their precious games.
Yeah, the same thing happened last time during the Olympics. I mean, it happens every time. I coming up on my show here in the next few weeks leading up to the Olympics, I'm going to have a protester who was at the Beijing Olympics. And,
right on.
Yeah, he was ousted from the country and lost his passport and his ability to travel internationally for, I think it's 5 years, for dropping a Free Tibet banner inside of the ceremony during the opening ceremonies. Pretty ingenious stuff. Yeah, so we're gonna have that cat on. Stimulator, how do you feel about taking a phone call right now?
Let's do it.
Okay, you're on the fucking air, whoever you are.
Hey.
Hey.
Stimulator.
Hey, how the fuck are you?
How's it going? This is Reverend Damien Lucas Ledbetter from the World Wide Web. I got a question for you.
Ask me.
Do you think Kanye West is upset because maybe Taylor Swift's distant ancestors used to own some of his distant ancestors?
Wait, who used to own Kanye West's ancestors?
Okay, I don't know who these fucking ass rods are, but apparently they like to listen to our show and call in.
Oh,
and talk
shit.
So, hey, who gives a shit about Kanye West, really? I mean, he's...
I mean, yeah, seriously.
That's a better question for you there, Reverend Ledbetter. Who gives a shit about Kanye West? Do you? You fucking wrong.
Yeah.
Okay. And he's gone.
And he shits.
All right. So every episode, it's funny. Our show goes out to a pretty wide audience, and generally I expect at least one or two callers with something intelligent to say, but I don't really get those callers. I got a lot of intelligent friends who listen to the show, but I get these fucking assholes who sit around listening to a show about anarchist resistance when there's at least 100 other shows they could be listening to, and they decide to call in with some stupid fucking question. So,
well, I could tell you, I just tweeted the phone number where to call, so it could be one of these motherfuckers who's following me on Twitter. So...
Well, thanks for
that might be my fucking fault.
The scum.
Maybe there's some douchebags out there who are following me on Twitter, and I'm not providing you with that quality audience.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, come on, a high class show like It's the End of the World doesn't have a high class audience? Are you kidding me?
You know, I am actually surprised by the quality of audience that I have. It's usually folks who are highly politicized, and also a lot of folks who are just basically seeking the truth, but people like not just young people, which is really my goal when I started the show, is to hit up like the MySpace generation. I mean, I'm hitting people who are older than me even, and it's just one of my favorite things to do right now is do the show, and it has been for the past 2.5 years.
Well, you know, I got to say, like when I first got turned on to your show, it was so fucking phenomenal to hear a voice like that. In this movement, we have so many people who privately are fucking hilarious people. You know, you sit around, we laugh a lot. People don't understand when they see these political protests and they see these activist groups, they must get the idea that we're so fucking serious all the time, but they have no idea how genuinely funny and hilarious most of the people are within the resistance movement, because the resistance movement doesn't showcase that publicly. You know, every time we address the public, it's some goddamn serious, you know, stern thing. But, you know, we don't take a laughing standpoint on it. And when I started listening to It's the End of the World, it was – I'm not blowing smoke up your ass. I was like, this is the fucking – like, this is the reporter of the revolution. This is the shit that's going to document the fucking revolution while it's happening. Like, this is the one voice that we're going to hear every fucking day when he gets a hold of the fucking airwaves and says, good morning, slaves. And it's fucking phenomenal. It's brilliant shit. It was inspiration for Anarchy Now, which was one of my favorite things to do till the fucking pigs took our recording equipment.
Well, you know, a couple of things. One, I hope you get your fucking equipment back. Number two, you know, we all have to remind ourselves that there's some fucked up shit out there for sure. I fucking cover it every time I do a fucking show. I mean, I read it on the news. It's just out there, right? We see it with my own fucking two eyes. And we gotta laugh. We gotta laugh, man, because we know we're gonna drive ourselves crazy. But I tell you what, and this is a little rant, is that motherfuckers like anarchists are too damn pure, too damn judgmental. We need to chill on that shit. We need to stop judging people. People are in all kinds of different situations. You see a motherfucker eating a cheeseburger, leave the motherfucker alone. Is he doing stuff for the resistance? Yes. Don't alienate a person because they're doing something that you deem politically incorrect. If you want to educate them, then do it gently. But you know, there's not that many of us. I mean, I know there's a lot of us, but we need more, and we don't need to be like these. You know, I feel like sometimes with the anarchists, I feel like I'm in like Catholic school again, and the nuns fucking shaming me for this and that or the other.
Well, is it any wonder that the largest portion of the anarchist community right now is still white males? I mean, it's no fucking wonder, because they still have that same fucking privileged aspect that they bring to the board at the fucking anarchist collectives, you know? I mean, It's extremely judgmental, extremely hypersensitive. That's the thing that really is fucking killing me, is the hypersensitivity of language and, you know, all this other shit. Like, yeah, okay, oppressive language is fucking bad. We know this. But don't always assume that somebody is using oppressive language when they use the language that they know effectively. Like, it's fucking bullshit. How many times, I have a band called Holy, 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 and we use some language that guaranteed every fucking time we play the Anarchist Collective, two or three anarchists will get all huffy puffy and pissed off about the language that we used in our fucking songs or in our poetry. And it's like, you know, if you want to fight something, fight the fucking idea that birthed that language. Don't fucking fight the kid who uses that language in a fucking effective way. Like, it's ridiculous. It's absolutely fucking ridiculous, the amount of censorship. Like, policing. It's fucking policing, period. You know, the lifestyleist anarchists go around policing everybody. It's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, and again, the guys who usually come after me are usually white guys. And I'm like, you know what, I'm just, no, sorry, dude, game over. But you know what, with that said, you know, I'm glad that the people out there who are conscientious. I just think that we just need to change the approach. And we need to understand too that there's people out there who are our allies. And instead, like, if I do something that pisses off somebody up in the air, I sure fucking hope so they tell me. But it's also the tone and the way in which they tell me. You know, I got this motherfucker like calling me a homophobic over the email, and I'm like, okay, well, you started off at the wrong foot, but I'm gonna hear you out because that's the type of guy I am. Let's have a conversation. But it's just, you know, he just decides to like berate me about my use of certain words that just might offend his sensitivity, and I think that we have bigger enemies out there than you coming out after me because I said that Bush took it up the ass or some shit. It's like, seriously, man. Go after the real motherfuckers out there. Don't come after me. Support me.
Well,
help me.
And look
help
at the fucking instance. You know, look at the context. The idea of George W. Bush taking something up the ass is completely fucking offensive to George W. Bush because he has no idea how fucking wonderful it might be to take something up the ass in a pleasurable way. But because he's so fucking homophobic, when you say he took it up the ass, that's completely fucking offensive to George W. Bush. Right?
Yeah. Well, you know, it almost becomes like a battle of semantics. And you know what? Like, I tell the person, it's like, of course I'm not homophobic. I just thought it would be funny if Bush took something up the ass. And, you know, yeah, exactly. And if I type it, I'm laughing my ass off. I'm like, I can't believe I'm typing this shit. And it just blows my fucking mind. But that's my rant on that shit. So we can put the kibosh on that. You motherfuckers are there, chill the fuck out. Every so often, I enjoy a little coffee, a little cheese, a little fish. I also dumpster dive when I can, but I'm mostly vegan. But you know, there's all these other more important things that you can give me shit about. You know, like, you know, if you saw me, like, I need a haircut. Say that, Frank. You need a haircut or stimulator.
Yeah, you know, the infighting thing is something I actually think that we should maybe talk about for a couple more minutes because it's really fucking prevalent right now, the infighting and the divisive tactics being brought into the anarchist community. Two topics on that, two incidents that I can think of clearly right now are John Zerzan trashing Derek Jensen on his fucking show. First of all, Jensen wasn't on the show to defend himself or to have the discussion or to be brought to accountability in the way that we talk about accountability. This was just one man pulling his shit out and talking as much shit as he possibly could about another person in the resistance. The other thing was the incidents with AIPOC at the Crime Scene Convergence in Pittsburgh this year.
Right.
You know, something that's really weighed heavy on my heart. It's fucking bullshit. Whether or not they were cops or not, which most people are saying that they know them and they can vouch for them that they're not cops, they use police tactics on other resistance fighters. I don't fucking understand that.
Yeah.
I just don't. You know, I get the idea. But here's the thing. They said that the reason that they did what they did was to showcase, you know, that there was a bunch of white people talking about gentrification in a black neighborhood. Okay, maybe. Would it not be more effective for you to go and kick down the fucking door of the white landowners in that area than to kick down the fucking door of a resistance movement and scare the shit and terrorize all your fucking comrades? You know, why are we putting our fucking resistance in the right place?
Yeah, no, it comes down to the same thing. It's like, do they know who their allies are? Like, couldn't they go after somebody who's truly oppressing them? I think that they called it something like, it was time to smack a white boy. And it's like, you know what, like, that's just amazingly counterproductive. And you know, I didn't
it's
read the entire... It's hilarious.
That's fucking funny. I'd wear a shirt that says that.
I know that the Reverend Dead Press and they're trying to be all hard and shit. But you know what? Like, again, not that many allies. Not that many of us. We don't have critical mass yet. We don't need to be making other people feel bad about the shit they're doing. I heard that people that basically all the women walked out. It's not right. So I mean, that argument just goes, you know, both ways. You get white on black, black on white, Latino on queer, on female. You know, we need to keep talking to each other, but we can't keep doing this shit. But there was the other thing that you talked about. What was it? Oh, Jones is on talking shit about Jensen. Is there a link to that? Because I keep hearing about this, but I never heard it.
Yeah, if you go to the website that hosts his radio show, if you just Google Green Anarchy Radio Show, it's I think it's hosted through the school in Eugene, which I believe is the University of Oregon. But if you Google that, you can find the show, and it's in the archives of the show. It's just a couple weeks ago. I was listening to a show on the internet, and he focused on, and I was listening to an archive show. I wasn't a live stream, otherwise I would have called in, and I plan on calling Zerzan. I talked to Jensen about this, and Jensen didn't want, while he was on the show, for me to bring this up because he doesn't really give a shit. He doesn't fucking care. It hurts him, but he doesn't want to fucking give Zerzan the time of day to discuss this shit. There's more important things for him to talk about. But for me and for this show, what the fuck? I'm going to talk about it because I think it's a fucking punk move. And, you know, I don't want to start talking shit about Zerzan. I don't want to take that route. But I do want to say that this is a fucking bullshit way to hold somebody accountable. And I've contacted Zerzan about being on the show and haven't gotten a fucking response. And when I get him on the show, better believe I'm going to bring it up. Because it's bullshit that he's trying to trash Jensen and call Jensen some kind of a sellout or saying that he's working for the fucking system because of some campaign that used Jensen as a poster boy for. You know, some liberal fucking reformist organization used Jensen. You know, who gives a shit? You know, I happen to think that Jensen's one of the greatest fucking assets we have right now as far as media goes with his writing. His writing is fucking brilliant. And it's touching, and it reaches people a lot better than Zerzan's does. Zerzan's writing is fucking good. The subject matter is fucking good. His content is fucking good. But Jensen has a way in writing to reach a lot broader audience than Zerzan does. It's kind of comparing Howard Zinn to Noam Chomsky, who happen to be really close friends. You know,
right.
You don't see those guys fighting with each other over who's doing what and where and when and why. And I just don't fucking get this. I don't understand why we're so fucking to the point where we're ready to shut the whole fucking world out and not take any comrades based on superficial bullshit ideas.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think that it's, again, very counterproductive. Let's talk about the greatness of Derek Jensen at the moment. You know, and this is not like, I'm not sucking his dick or anything like that to really offend some people out there. But anyway, I had a conversation. I had a conversation with a good friend of mine a while back, and we're talking about quote-unquote advertising anarchism. Like, how do we get anarchy to other audiences? And I really talk about my experience, which was, really the crime thing book, Days of War, Nights of Love. I mean, that did it for me. I was that began my journey into this wonderful way of living, and this wonderful way of thinking, and this wonderful way of just being in this world.
It's
and
a very
it's because
joyous
these
life.
Guys,
it's a very joyous life.
Whatever they are, make also the book and they make you feel they take all the guilt that I was just talking about all these animals. It's like, hey, listen, don't feel guilty about anything. You know, we're all on our path or whatever. We're all going to try to do our best. Every so often we're going to fuck up, but it doesn't mean that we got to give up just because we fuck up on this thing or another, right? Well, anyway, I digress. Jensen is like Krang in that sense. He is such an amazing writer that he is writing about taking out dams. And you know, and I ask people about that, and they nod their heads. They're like, you know what? Like, I understand. I understand what he's saying. I understand why we need to take out civilization. You know, he makes a strong argument. He does it eloquently. He does it with humor. And I think that, you know, Zersan could be like Jensen's grandfather in a way, in terms of, like, you know, maybe he's not the originator of, like, anti-civilization primitivist thought, but he was there, you know, a while back. And sure. And I know that Jensen helps Zersan as well. Like, I know that at some point or another, there used to be some sort of, like, you know, they were pals. So I would like to listen to the show, but I question Zersan's motivations. Like, why, what does he gain with this? You know, if he has beef with Jensen, why doesn't taking up with him personally? It's almost like when the activists in St. Paul were organizing for the RNC, they made a pact that they were not going to talk shit about each other on the media. That any beef they had within each other, all the organizing groups, all the divergences that they had, if they had problem with the way each other was doing business, they were gonna try to solve it behind closed doors and not, like, put their laundry out there and make people, like, turn off to be part of this movement. So that's
right.
That's my two cents on that shit.
And it has to be understood that this is very different from walking a party line, and this is really sketchy territory because, like, with communists. For instance, the American Communist Party, I was asked to give a talk at the National Communist Gathering recently, and I submitted what my talk was going to be about because I'm an IWW member. I was a long time doing a lot of talks around in the area here about labor organizing and wildcat strikes. And since then, I've changed a lot of what my focus is, but I still believe in those forms of resistance. But I was asked to give a talk, and I said, well, if I give a talk, my subject is going to be when communism becomes religion. And they shot it down because they didn't want to have anything spoken against the party at all. And this is very different what we're talking about here in not airing our dirty laundry, because it's not like we don't want people to know that we're imperfect, because we are imperfect. And it's not like we're trashing the sacred name of anarchism by doing those things. But it's just bullshit in a community of people who are talking about creating better relationships to use any opportunity they can to bring down somebody else publicly without having that person there. Now, if Zersan had a problem with Jensen, wanted to have him on the show discuss those things, that to me would seem to be an appropriate format for discussing the dirty laundry. You know, if you want to do it publicly, do it together publicly. But, you know, it's not like we can't have these debates and these discussions. We can, and we can do those things publicly, but there has to be a better way to do it than just talking shit. You know,
absolutely.
And I think that we do that. Some people do that. One thing that I think is vitally missing from this movement is the public discourse, is the public debates. I mean, we look back through history, and we have Foucault and Chomsky is a great fucking debate. I mean, if you ever get a chance to YouTube the Chomsky-Foucault debates, you know, YouTube that shit, because they're fucking great. They're long, and sometimes it's dry, but, you know, you got two great philosophic minds coming together to hash it out with each other publicly. And this should form unity as opposed to forming divisions.
I totally disagree, and I, you know, I think, like, I think in a certain degree, like, Zersan as, you know, he has put himself in this position where he needs to be called out publicly now. Like, this is, I mean, he did it in the public sphere, then we need to call him out on the public sphere as well.
To get Zersan on this show. Zersan will be on Burn, and we will fucking work this out. I tried to get Zersan on with Jensen, but neither party wanted to necessarily take part in that. So I'll get Zerzan by himself in a corner, and I'll fucking berate him. I don't fuck. It's my show. Well, let's talk about NCIV.
All right. Well, let's see. Let's start from the very beginning.
In the first hour, I played a clip, by the way, from NCIV, one of the ones that you sent me, talking about occupation, the government of occupation. Clip.
Oh, right on.
I played the Jensen version, not the stimulator version.
Absolutely. I've been kicking around the idea of NCIV for about 3 years, and I feel like, well, actually, specifically after the RNC and the DNC were done, I was like, I just gotta finish this. I gotta make it happen, just because I think, you know. Not that this film is going to save the world, but I think that I would love to send more people to the books, so they can make their own mind. And there's a few analogies that Jensen does on his book, and the government of occupation is one of the better ones. And it's just the idea, like, if for those who were not here while that clip played. That if there was an occupying army in North America, in the United States, or in Canada, like the Nazis, like, you knew these are the fucking Nazis, what are you going to do? Are you going to let them, like, fucking create a Holocaust of your people, or are you going to, like, you know, join the guerrillas and fight them, you know? And so it's this idea that, like, let's think about this, that are we living in an occupied society? In the sense that more towards nature, right? Like, we are attacking nature. We are attacking our spirits. We are attacking the deepest parts of not just of the natural world, but of our humanity. Everything's being poisoned. It is almost like a fascist machinery of destruction, and we need to see that as an enemy that we need to fight with everything that we got, and I think that is one of those powerful analogies that said, you know, it seems so obvious now, you see it, you hear the analogy, or at least I did, and I'm like, holy shit, that's absolutely true. And so, that's one of the pieces of the film. But what I hope to accomplish with the film is not just be like a Jensen love fest. Is to have folks like John Zerzan, like Lear Keith, like my friend Quatsinas up in Bella Coola, folks who know that the destruction is happening and who can attest. We need to resist. This is. We're not going to accomplish this by signing a petition.
You want me to play that clip?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, and you've been through this clip enough that you know the editing around the clip. You know where the quiet parts are. If you feel like you want to jump in while this clip is playing and give us a little bit of editorial, this will be like the special features on the DVD. You know, where you hear, like, Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones talking about Men in Black while the movie's playing.
Right, for
if
sure.
I feel like talking on the quiet parts, because people aren't going to be able to see the amazing footage that you've accumulated to go along with the imagery that's being spoken about. So I'm going to play this clip. It's about 6 minutes long, and so, but if you feel like jumping in during the quiet parts, please feel free. This is from NCIV. This is a rough cut featuring Quatsinas, and you can find this on YouTube if you just Google clear cuts and YouTube search clear cuts and NCIV or clear cuts and stimulator. You'll find.
Or they can just go to NCIV.com, and it's the third clip down, or it's the second clip down.
Oh, well, perfect. Yeah, I put that in the chat room before, NCIV.com. So again, it's www.endciv.com, ENDCIV.com. But here it is.
Okay, so what's happening now is some some footage, some loggers, old footage of logger, black and white, and they're basically chopping down these massive, massive redwoods. This gentleman is actually tied kind of like halfway up the tree with a rope, and he's just hacking at it, and you see this massive tree, this kind of giant of a beautiful tree just going down in slow motion. And now you see a close-up of a logger chopping another humongous tree, and it's kind of like a pan, so it starts at the bottom and it starts going up to basically reveal this giant.
My God, the tree is so big.
Oh, and this next one, yeah, it's just gigantic. It's taking two guys to cut it with double-sided axes.
So as a long-time grassroots environmental activist and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains, drop into valleys, climb ridges, fragment watershed after watershed, and I've sat silent near empty streams that two generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die.
Out here in BC and across North America, when they do industrial logging, they actually take and just move all the trees. They level everything. They leave nothing but stumps and slash piles. And they burn the slash piles and they take out all the timber. And what's left is a wasteland. It's like they take a rainforest and turn it into a desert. That's what a clear cut is.
Now you see clear cuts in Vancouver Island, a massive, massive clear cuts around the Walbron Valley. And you see my feet. I was actually shooting this with a handheld, and you could tell that it's actually very hard to walk on these clear cut pieces of land.
They use them for pulp. They export them whole to the United States and to Japan. There's not very much milling that happens anymore in BC. It's just getting exported for pulp and paper and fiberboard and plywood and whatever else. Not a lot of value added.
Industrial civilization, civilization itself, but especially industrial civilization, is not and can never be sustainable. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last.
There's still a strong push to harvest as much of the western red cedar as they can. They're bringing in huge helicopters to do that. And they're high-grading, selecting only the really good high-quality timber and leaving the rest laying there. A junk heap. So that's why we keep on, fighting back. I think the last straw was when they wanted to log the Valley of Ista because of its historical and spiritual significance to our people. But they log it in spite. To make a point against our resistance, against our overall position, with regards to treaties or encroachments of industry development in our territories.
And you see big logs falling to water.
A lot of these areas, like this clearing behind me up on the hill, you can see the soil is exposed. The ultraviolet kills off all the mosses, funguses that hold the forest, to hold the soil together. When the stumps rot and the roots die, then the slopes slide. And often there's not much regrowth. There's no regeneration of the forest. They do some replanting. It doesn't always work because there's no soil left. It washes down into the streams. It kills the salmon. It fills up the reservoirs. It causes all kinds of flood damage downstream.
That's terrorism. Stripping down all the trees, ripping out the trees in the forest, and now they're going to rip out the guts of the land with them, looking for copper and gold. And there has to be some kind of focus to it.
address the injustice to our people, the injustice to the land, to the water, to the wildlife, the injustice to the marine life and the salmon life, and the injustice to the people that want to stand up for it.
The thing is, when we block the road, these trees are very valuable, and the laws are all profit-driven. They're all driven by the corporations. The police are there to enforce the corporation's right to log, not to enforce our right to stop them and protect the ecosystem. There's so little that's left of the old-growth forest like this that we see on the sides here that people are putting their bodies on the line. They are willing to make huge sacrifices to stop the forest from being sacrificed and the water and the air quality and the global climate.
Find ways to fight and protect what we have here. Just look at this place. Beautiful place. Why would you want to destroy it?
I think those last words from Quatsinas really says it all.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he says, it's just a simple statement of find ways to fight. I mean, people want to say, well, what's your solution or what's the answer or what do we do? There's the answer. Just find ways to fight.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of our listeners are from the anarchist community, and, a lot of them do understand the different ways of resistance, but some of our listeners are not. And when she was talking about blocking the roads, let's talk about that for a second, because it's great footage that you have that you found or that I don't know if you shot it or you found it, but of roadblocks and of occupations of land that's about to be destroyed by timber companies, which this occurs pretty often, and people don't understand that. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, no, the footage was appropriated from a great film called Pickaxe, and it's a film about forest defense in Oregon.
That's
and
a crime think film is for people that don't know.
It's actually not a crime think film. A crime think actually just packaged it into a DVD. It's an awesome two DVD set that they sell for $10. That is just fucking brilliant. That has a film about the Doteo. It's got the Pickaxe. And it's got the Miami model. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's also got a bunch of great short films.
Well, thank you. It's got a couple of some media films in there as well. And also some films by a group called Think Tank as well. Roadblocks is actually a way that Native people used to resist as well. It's a very simple concept, and this civilization runs on petroleum-based transportation. Everything's moved via trucks, and if you want to stop something from going through an area that's going to be destroyed, then you block the road. In this case, these folks got like junked out vehicles, and they parked them, and I don't remember exactly, they smashed the tires or whatever, but they basically make the vehicles very, very difficult to move out of the way, and then people chain themselves to this vehicle to make it even harder, because if people move the vehicles, then people who are chained to them are going to get hurt, and the cops don't want that because there's cameras around and blah blah. So that's one way to do it. And in Oregon, I think it happens every summer. There's usually a Cascadia, a forest action. I think the one this summer was pretty successful. Although I don't know how success is measured these days.
Sure.
I think that's one of the things that we need to also talk about.
There's an immediate success in just taking the action. Whether or not you win or lose the battle, just standing up and fighting is an immediate success. However, the long-term sustainability of that success is only going to be measured by the amount of push that comes following that action. I think Greece is a really good example of that. That if in December, when the anarchists fought back and retaliated for the murder of one of their comrades, if there was no push from the rest of the community to continue that fight of resistance, then that would have fizzled away. But it was supported, and it was supported by people who were – it was supported by nonviolent protesters. It was supported by other violent protesters, and both sides both of nonviolent and the violent actions really supported these actions, and I think that's what people need to understand.
Yeah, but you know what? I think this is something I always like to talk about too, because and I know that you understand this concept, so I won't take this that much into it. But I think people really need to like check their language when they talk about violence. There's a lot of people out there who advocate sabotage and property destruction against inanimate objects. And I personally define violence as against living beings. Basically, the violence that I see is usually logging companies destroying trees. It's usually oil companies destroying like beautiful boreal forests to extract motherfucking tar sands. That's violence to me. If somebody trashes a truck that's about to perpetuate violence, I see that as defense. I don't see that as violence. And I think that actually in Breaking the Spell, that the first film about the World Trade Organizations, I remember there was this lady who was, they asked this lady, what did she think about the smashing of the windows that basically made the whole North America understand, or at least ask what the WTO was fucking, what the fuck was the WTO, right? Like before those windows were smashed, most people didn't know what the WTO was, right? So they asked this lady, what do you think about this violence? She's like, I'm not down with it or whatever. And then they ask her, what do you think about the Boston Tea Party? And she's like, oh, that was great. And it's like, you know,
we
can't make
the connections. We've had the ability to make connections stolen away from us. I mean, the stealing away of nature from us when we're born onto concrete and we're put into schools and we're fed fast food, that steals our connections to anything. If you steal the connection to the earth, you've stolen the ability to connect to anything at all. So you can't make those connections. It takes a lot of unschooling to make those connections. From historical resistance to what's happening now. We have a call. Do you mind if we take another quick call?
Let's do it.
Go ahead, caller.
All right, I have a question. What do you think about these groups like the Branch Davidians? What do you think about Timothy McVeigh? What do you think about domestic terrorism in general in the United States?
Well, it's a pretty broad question, but I'll try to tackle them really fast. Branch Davidians, I'm not pro religion, but you know, if you want to rock it like that and have a commune where you love Jesus together, I'm totally cool with that. I'm fine with that. What the government did to those people is an awful thing, and in a way it woke a lot of people up. And he woke a young disturbed man called the. Well, I don't know if he was disturbed. I'll just back out of that and take that one back. It woke up Timothy McVeigh. I don't know if Tim McVeigh was the sole person who perpetrated the thing on the Oklahoma City bombing, but there were a lot of innocent people in that building, and I can't really say that I can get behind that, right? But I understood his frustration. I understood what he was trying to fight. He actually had just come back from the war. He had just seen what a big bunch of bullshit the first Gulf War was, and he was questioning a lot. And then when he saw what was happening in Waco on TV, he actually drove down there himself and witnessed women and children being murdered by our government, by, you know, Janet Reno and a Democrat called Bill Clinton. And I think that, you know, like Ward Churchill says, like some people push back. It's just the way it is.
Okay, well, I guess. Well, I just want to know, like, what? Okay, you said innocent people in Oklahoma City, but like, what's the difference between? Is there like a continuum of innocence? Because the children that were killed in Waco, Texas, and the children that were killed in Oklahoma City, what's the difference?
I would say there is no difference, and that's one thing that we have to understand. Is that there is no difference in the murders of innocent people, whether it's done by the state or done by a resistance fighter. There is no difference in those forms of violence. What the major difference is in the action themselves, outside of the deaths of the innocent people, is the motivation and the means. The state always has the means to enact those murderous actions as often as they wish, with a bulk amount of support from the people that they claim to represent, allowing them to do it or taking a blind eye to it. Whereas Timothy McVeigh taking the same actions that the state took was viewed as being some kind of terrorist action as opposed to being a state-sanctioned action. Now, again, I also don't back Timothy McVeigh because I understand that Timothy McVeigh was very racist and had a lot of racist motivations for what he did. But I do understand the action. I do understand the want to take down that building. I do understand his motivation for it. It's the same thing as Columbine. When Columbine first happened, I remember sitting with my friends and we were talking. We were all punk rockers. We were all in school. And pretty much unanimously, all of us agreed that something was refreshing about that action. Whether or not, and it may be a horrible thing to admit and a horrible thing to say publicly, but there was something refreshing about that, that somebody was striking back against the bullies, the bully mentality of the state, the bully mentality of the school, the bully mentality of the upper class at school. And what they did may have been wrong, it may have been fucked up, but the fact that they stood up and took action was refreshing in that somebody was taking action. And what they did was wrong, and I don't support the killings of all those innocent children. But what I'm saying is we have to understand that those killings take place on a daily basis enacted by the state. Let's look at the move 9. Let's look at various groups. But MOVE specifically had their house bombed by the state in New Jersey. They had their house bombed. Innocent people were being burned alive and killed simply because they were a resistance group. Branch Davidians had their house destroyed. Now, I don't necessarily get behind what was happening on in Waco. I don't know exactly, but I do know that I will oppose and resist the government taking the authority to come in and kill these people. If there was a problem with that community should be able to handle that problem themselves.
Wow.
I'm in.
Really good answers, man.
Amen. Well, listen, you know, I hate to be a party pooper, but my time is up, my friend.
Well, our show is over, actually. The show's been over for about 3 minutes. This is all going to be on the download, though, but this is not playing live anymore. But, caller, thanks for the question. It was a very good and valid question, and I'm glad that you got the answer you were looking for, or maybe not what you were looking for, but you got an answer that you seem to be pleased with.
I can relate. I can relate to your answers. It's just, I don't know. It's real hard to, I don't know. It's just hard to understand, you know.
And it should be. That, you know, never let violence be easy to understand. That's the biggest thing that I think the state does, is they make it, from when we're very young, makes it very easy for us to understand military action. And it should not be an easy thing to digest. It should be a disgusting and sickening thing every time innocent people are killed. Every time.
But I think we should definitely be able to discuss it openly and express, you know, our feelings about it in you know, the media and stuff. And I don't think we're able to do that now because people are afraid they're going to go on a list or, like you said, you know, their house is going to be bombed or whatever. So,
hey fellas, I hate to interrupt, but I do really have to go.
Okay,
I'll be in touch. Mike, thank you so much again, man. And,
it was great having you on the show, Stimulator.
Let's do this again sometime, man.
Absolutely.
Peace out, brother.
All right, take care, man. Yeah, caller, I absolutely agree. And I would say that their fears are not unwarranted, that we definitely are put on lists. And I would guarantee that I'm on a list. And I would guarantee that most likely now that you called into this show, you're on a list. But you know what?
I probably won't be with us.
The bigger their list gets, the more people we have on our side. That's the way I see it.
Yeah.
You know, the bigger the list gets of enemies, the bigger the army of resistance is going to have to be.
Yeah, maybe the fear will change places. I think it's slowly doing that. But
well, they've been scared for years. You know, one thing that we know about animals in the wild is that they don't lash out and attack unless they're scared. And if we look at how much police attack and how much the state uses the military action, we could see that they're fucking scared. They are scared to death because they know that if at any moment the people get the idea that they want to be free and they understand their own slavery, if people understand that, at a moment everything could shift and they could lose all of their power.
Yeah. Yeah, freedom's a two-edged sword. It's a squirrely thing, but I don't know.
Absolutely.
Just trying to understand it. But thanks for what you're doing, man.
Yeah, man. Thanks for calling in, and everybody, thanks for listening in. Check with us next week. on Bottom Up Radio Network. We'll have the return of the G20 Side of Die and myself, and we may have a guest. If you want to look up Joel Salentino, or just check out YouTube, search the movie Fresh, F-R-E-S-H. It's a farming movie that's out right now, and he's one of the farmers in the movie. He's a fucking phenomenal witness to being a steward of the earth, and he wrote a book recently called Everything I Want to Do Is Illegal, and it's all about him being a farmer and how the country is making that illegal for him to farm according to the rights of the land, not according to the ways of the government. So tune in next week for that, next Sunday, 8 p.m. In the meantime, shoot us an email at bottomupradionetwork@gmail.com and let us know what's on your mind. Suggest a guest or ask to be a guest on the show. Send us your MP3s to be played on the show. And everybody, go out there this week and have some fucking fun with each other and figure out a way to resist, as Quatina says. Figure it out, because it needs to be done. So thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in, and we'll catch you next week when the resistance will be that much stronger.